If I knew you were coming, I'd bake the cake.
Adam Lepp!
Yes, that's my name, Adam Lepp, and good morning. Thank you very much for lending an ear to this radio station. I can assure you that it is going to be 48 minutes well worth your while. We call this show Mid-Morning Coffee Break with Adam. I was on last hour with the Adam the Computer Guy radio show talking about technology topics and news from the world of technology, computers, servers, and smartphones that are smart or sometimes not very smart. This show is called Mid-Morning Coffee Break with Adam. So grab your favorite coffee or tea or other hot or cold beverage. Turn up the volume. We're going to be discussing current events on this show, and I am privileged to have a frequent guest, a good friend of mine and of the station's, on the line with me. His name is Dr. Ronald Feynman. He is in his domicile in beautiful Boca Raton, Florida, where I'm sure it's quite warm and humid. He's an expert on presidents, American history, politics, and we'll be discussing not only the current events of the last few days, but some ramblings, rumblings, and tumblings and mumblings going on in our nation's capital. Good morning, Ron. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing fine, Adam. Thank you again for inviting me.
Always a pleasure. How is the weather there in Boca Raton? Is it hot and humid, or maybe a little bit milder?
Exactly, hot and humid. You're precisely right. That's what it is most of about 4 or 5 months in South Florida over the summer.
Unfortunately,
we have spring the rest of the year.
Right, you have two seasons. Of course, where I went to college, just south of Ottawa, Ontario, we had two seasons, winter and July. And where you are, you have spring
yes.
and summer. But you're a native of the Big Apple of NYC, where, like here in Ohio, you do have four defined seasons. Anyway, Ron, unfortunately, a lot of the current events we're going to talk about are very tragic, and we like to keep the show on a positive note, but the current events of the last few days, I think, are things we need to talk about and address and maybe analyze and delineate just a bit. Coming up later later today, Ron, will be Jared Taylor. He'll be on with Scott for the Now program between about 1:13 p.m. and 2. He is a white nationalist. He was on earlier this year, Ron. What is your opinion about Scott having the white nationalist on in the wake of all the recent events? Is it good to give both perspectives, or what's your take on that?
I am in support of having him be exposed for what he is, and the only way is for people to be aware of who he is. So I totally agree with his appearing on radio or television. While, of course, I consider him disgraceful and despicable, but I do believe that it's necessary that we know the enemy.
So it's good to have both perspectives, and whether or not you agree with what a guest has to say, having him or her on the air is a good thing.
And you're I absolutely agree with that.
And you're with me that freedom of the press, it's a biased opinion, obviously, since I'm
freedom of speech and freedom of the press, yes.
Right. And you,
First
again,
Amendment.
Right, being an author and lecturer and blogger, it's one of the things that we hold dear as Americans.
Absolutely.
And having someone on, even if you don't agree with that person's opinion, even if it's extreme, is important. And that's why we invite your phone calls, emails, and Facebook messages and feedback, as we are certainly, if anything, an audience and listener participation station. Something we've talked about on messaging and over the phone, Ron, has been what is the president's obligation to step in, to talk, to try to mediate an unfortunate situation like the one in Charlottesville? And there's been a lot of talk about how President Trump has not really stepped up like he should, like other presidents have. And
he has not stepped up. Even yesterday's statement, he mentions the names, but you could see he was almost like forced into it, and the white supremacists and white nationalists, Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazi, neo-Confederate groups are still applauding him, because we must remember that he ran a campaign appealing to these elements, and he represents those elements in what he says and what he has asserted over the last few years, coming out for a Mexico wall, coming out for a Muslim ban, and also his racist and nativist and misogynistic comments. And it disturbs me that this young lady who was killed, on Saturday, that the right-wing Nazi and other group websites like that are talking about how she was overweight and she didn't have any children and that she was a waste of humankind. And it shows, besides lack of respect for the dead, shows lack of respect for women also and makes an issue of their weight. And, of course, Trump makes an issue of weight, and he's got a weight problem. There's a lot of mental illness involved in these people with what they assert and what they say. And it really sickened me when I saw the attack on this woman. It's just horrible.
So, ironically, Donald Trump kind of talks on both sides of his mouth and also would appear to be misogynistic. Again, that's open to interpretation, and we do invite listeners to let me know what they think about this. He speaks about women who may not be look like the cover of a Playboy magazine, yet he hardly has an athletic body himself. Despite all of his golfing, he is one of our heaviest presidents.
Well, golfing is not really an exercise, I don't consider, any more than bowling is. That's not real exercise.
Especially the way that I bowl. Not much exercise for the pencil either, with all the gutter balls that I tend to throw. So every year, Ron, it's getting harder to bowl my age. And golf my age would certainly be...
Well, supposedly practice makes perfect, but I'm not so sure with bowling.
Yeah, definitely, in my case, for sure. It was never one of my main proclivities, for sure. So we do find the President Donald, as I call him, to be a bit hypocritical. And again, I think
A bit? That's understated.
Yeah, hypocrisy can be a human nature, but when you're the president, you are held to a higher standard. And how he's conducting himself, we agree, may not always be very presidential, despite the fact that he feels that he is the second most presidential president since Abraham Lincoln.
Well, he's delusional, needless to say. He definitely is from another planet. Maybe he's an alien from outer space, I sometimes wonder.
Now, you feel, Ron, and I would tend to agree that Donald Trump will not be completing his four-year presidency, which means that Mr. Pence will become number 46 or number 45, again, depending on how you count it.
Well, 46 officially, but 45th person, yes.
Right. Now, my understanding is that Mike Pence has come out in support of the way Donald Trump has responded to this this tragedy. And how would that affect his ascension to the presidency if and when that does happen?
Well, Mike Pence is in a bit of a bind. He has to, in his mind, be loyal to the president, and yet he needs to, and he's not doing it, separate himself from him. He's not doing what Gerald Ford did in the Nixon Watergate scandal, where he avoided getting into the fray, and as we would say, walked on eggs without cracking them. In the case of Mike Pence, he's walking on eggs and cracking them, and I think he loses a lot of his moral authority to be the next president. By the fact that he's unwilling to openly criticize, and I know it would be an awkward situation. But honestly, one thing about this is Mike Pence cannot be fired by Donald Trump. The vice president cannot be fired, and it would be shocking, I guess, if he came out and was critical in a mild way. But I think he needs to, because I just think that he's going to have a horrible, situation of inheritance after Trump if he does not start to separate himself from Trump, at least in some form.
We are speaking with Dr. Ronald Fineman, a frequent guest on my show and Scott Spears' show, an expert in politics and history, a published author. He's written two books. We may discuss the book that he wrote 35 years ago if we have time during this show. He does make book signings, mostly in his current residence area of South Florida. And also, Ron, we want to celebrate that this is your 10th appearance on WWGH Radio.
Yes, that's correct. That's true. You're right. It is number 10. That's really good. I'm very appreciative of the opportunity.
I could sing happy anniversary to you, but that might turn off a few listeners, so I will pass.
There's no need for that.
I will pass at this point. As I like to say, I have more of a talking voice than a singing voice, and some people have both. I, again, speak better than I do sing, to put it mildly, but I do enjoy belting out a tune every now and then. So,
are you drinking? Meaning alcohol, or are you just singing normally?
I would say that singing can be a little bit like the opposite of driving. I do better if I have had a couple cold ones. So perhaps It also does keep the mouth more moist, and you're able to sing and use the very little vocal range that I have. So a Miller Lite or two sometimes does help when singing a song or two. But again, don't look for me on the cover of any record albums anytime soon. So, Ron, as we've kind of talked about, obviously one of the VP's jobs is to be the a cheerleader for the president, for his boss. And I do say he again because all VPs have been men, but that hopefully will change at some time in our lifetime. But in the case of Gerald Ford, distancing yourself from the president, especially one involved in controversy like Nixon and certainly like Trump currently, isn't necessarily a bad idea, but how does a VP balance that? And what might be your suggestion for Mike Pence in terms of balancing his own obligation to be a supporter and cheerleader for Donald Trump versus his ethical obligation to distance himself on some controversies?
Well, honestly, I would not be presumptuous to give him advice, but I do think that any chance for him to have any success as president when he becomes it is to have separated himself a certain amount. I realize he cannot repudiate the president, but he needs to still show he's his own man. And again, the president could be angry at him. Well, tough luck. That's the way it is, but he cannot fire him. He's still next in line under the Constitution, and he needs to speak up, you know, ethically and morally when Trump is wrong.
So the president is the VP's boss, but the VP was elected as the running mate. So again, I'm not the expert in history that you are, so I'm going to ask you. The president cannot fire the VP for any reason, right? That can never happen.
That's correct.
So what, and again, you would know more than I would. Certainly there have been presidents and vice presidents who have not gotten along well. I mean, some were close. Carter and Mondale kind of come to mind, who were kind of similar. Biden and Obama, I think, to an extent. But do you think the relationship between Trump and Pence is tense? Well, it does rhyme, but that wasn't on purpose. And do you know from your vast
age... Actually, I would think behind the scenes there probably is some tension, although it has not been leaked, which is interesting. So I don't know what to make of that. But I would think there must be, because I cannot believe that Pence, who claims to be so highly moral and ethical and is such a, quote, good Christian, that he would sit and take all that's going on with Trump and not be disturbed by it. But he's putting on a good front. I think he's probably lying in public. Sometimes I sense that he's not comfortable, but he always seems to be a cheerleader, but I think it's mostly phony. But he's, I guess, feeling the torture of having to be on both sides of the issue, and it's very hard to be that. But I think for his own standing in history, whatever comes out about his future career, he needs to speak up when he disagrees. But, of course, he does have to be a sharp critic, but he does need to separate himself when necessary, and he hasn't really done it in public.
From your studies, Ron, again, much more substantial than mine, what were some of the most tense relationships between presidents and VPs, especially over the last 100 years?
Of course, the famous ones are of course, Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. When Aaron Burr tried to steal the election of 1800, although he was the running mate of Jefferson, and they did not really deal with each other after Jefferson was elected by the House of Representatives in 1801, and he was dumped by Jefferson, meaning he told Burr, "You're not going to run with me in 1804 for my second term." And then, of course, John C. Calhoun, who was vice president under Andrew Jackson, there was a major split between them over the idea of secession, the idea of states' rights, the idea of nullification, and came close to the point where it looked as if Jackson might challenge Calhoun to a gun duel. And when Calhoun resigned 3 months to go in the term, because he was not going to be running with Jackson for the second term, there was talk of the South Carolina government nullifying the protective tariff at the time, the nullification crisis, as it is called, and leaving the Union. And Jackson made a threat that if South Carolina refused to obey the protective tariff and tried to secede from the Union, that Jackson would lead troops himself. Of course, Jackson had been a military general in the War of 1812 and after the war in the invasion of Florida, that he would lead troops into South Carolina and he would, quote, hang Calhoun from the nearest tree, end quote. So you could see there was real tension there. Thank goodness Henry Clay of Kentucky, Senator Henry Clay, negotiated an agreement and avoided the possibility in 1833 of civil war, but it actually was a possibility at that point. So those are the two cases of real tension, Jefferson and Burr in 1801 and after, and even more so Jackson and Calhoun in the late 1820s, early 1830s. Now, there's also other cases of vice presidents that were totally ignored, pretty much. Woodrow Wilson's vice president, Thomas Marshall, was not even given medical details about Wilson's stroke in his second term, and he was totally clueless. And also, we have, of course, Hannibal Hamlin, Lincoln's first vice president, who Mrs. Lincoln hated and basically realized there's no point in being in D.C., and he went home to Maine and was mostly in Maine during his vice presidency.
So there have been rifts between VPs and presidents in the past.
Particularly the big two ones, you know, the two big ones. But, of course, that's a long time ago. But we also know that Humphrey and Johnson, and Lyndon Johnson, had problems because Humphrey was uncomfortable about the Vietnam War escalation, and Johnson told him, either you go out and speak for me, or else I will not invite you to cabinet meetings. I will make you a non-entity. So Humphrey went out and spoke for the Vietnam War, and later when he ran in 1968, he had trouble separating himself from that. And I think that was a factor in his defeat to Richard Nixon.
Would you agree, though, that the relationship between Pence and Trump does kind of stick out a bit, because it does seem like Biden and Obama, Mondale and Carter, and even Cheney and Bush, that they were pretty close, and they agreed with a lot of things and seemed to work well together?
Yes, except Cheney in the second term, Bush was separating himself from Cheney in the second term. The first term, many people thought that Cheney was really president instead of George W. Bush. But as far as Biden and Obama, very, very close, and Carter Mondale, extremely close, probably more than anybody has been. And of course, the thing that's interesting is it's been now almost 41 years since Carter and Mondale were elected, and almost, by the end of the year, 37 years since they left, and they're both still alive. Carter's going to be 93 on October 1st, and of course, Walter Mondale is going to be 80 in January. So it's an amazing thing to have had such a long time since they were elected and since they left, and they're both alive, and that's never happened with any other presidential, vice presidential team, and they still keep in touch.
Ron, if I had Mr. Carter on the phone instead of yourself, and I asked him the same question about vice presidents getting along, who he got along with, Mondale, and versus Pence and Trump, what do you think he would say?
He would say, I think, Carter, that Mondale had his own mind, that they tended to agree on issues, that they discussed it, you know, within the cabinet and within private meetings. They had regular private meetings. That Mondale was a loyal, you know, person to him, but that, you know, they both respected each other. I am not sure, truthfully, that Trump respects anybody. So although he claims to love Mike Pence, as he says, he basically is loyal to no one but himself. So I think Pence knows that. So I think that's the awkward situation that he's in, that he wants to be president and thinks he will be, but it's a question of how do you balance that against how you deal with the president when he's such a wacko in the way he reacts to situations.
Talking again to Dr. Ronald Fineman, frequent guest and friend of the station, his 10th appearance this year on WWGH Radio. I'm not going to sing happy anniversary again because that might turn you off, but want to let you know we really appreciate him being on the air with us. Always interesting, and like any guest on this station and this show, always a surprise or two. Ron, as you may have heard, chief executives of Merck, which has a very big presence in Columbus, by the way, Under Armour and Intel, have quit a presidential manufacturing council. This happened yesterday after Donald Trump took 2 days to denounce white supremacy. Kenneth Frazier of Merck, who is one of the most prominent black executives in this country, said the nation's leaders, quote, must honor our fundamental values by clearly rejecting expressions of hatred, bigotry, and group supremacy. And we've talked about how companies often get involved in politics, and their CEOs are not shy about expressing their viewpoints. Do you agree with these executives? Should they have stepped away like they did, or should they maybe not get so involved in politics?
I think what he did was perfect and proper, and it disturbs me that within a short time after, on Twitter, Trump is attacking him while he doesn't, you know, attack white supremacists for 48 hours. And of course, the fact that the head of this company is African American, I think, is telling because of his own past comments, Trump's, about racial matters. So I think it just adds to the bad image that Trump has. And I think he's incorrigible. And as people say, he's 71. He's not changing. And I think he divides the nation, and he's promoting much more racial division than any president has ever done in modern times.
Now, Kevin Plank from Under Armour, he said Under Armour engages in innovation and sports, not politics. He said he would continue to focus efforts on inspiring every person that they can do anything through the power of sport, which promotes unity, diversity, and inclusion. Intel's CEO, Brian Krzanich, said we should honor, not attack, those who have stood up for equality and other cherished American values. I hope this will change, and I remain willing to serve when it does. I resign because I want to make progress, while many in Washington seem more concerned with attacking anyone who disagrees with them. So is there an obligation, Ron? We talked last hour about Bill Gates making a very large donation, again, along with his wife, tremendous philanthropists. That's a hard word to say, especially at 10 o'clock in the morning. So what is the obligation, or what do you think about CEOs of big companies? Should they get involved like this? And as you said, they do have a duty to let their ethics and their principles step in when there's a controversy like this.
Absolutely, I think they should intervene. I don't think you can stay on the sidelines when it comes to basic equality, justice, and diversity. Absolutely, I would agree with all these corporate leaders. It's also, however, good politics for them with the general public, which, after all, is a diverse public. So I think they really are principled, but it's also good business.
So again, not just from an ethical standpoint, but it's good for business. It does show that Intel, Under Armour, Merck and other companies do care about their customers, about Americans, especially Merck being in the pharmaceutical business. And that one touches me because they do have a big presence in nearby Columbus. So we do see some local influence there. So we talked about an obligation of people to speak out or make changes, or maybe resign a post when there's something going on that's troublesome. Donald Trump took a couple days to denounce the white supremacy and the bigotry and hatred. That's obviously not very presidential. And the president does have an obligation. If someone else were in office, let's take two very different presidents, Obama versus maybe President Reagan. How would they have reacted? And what do you think Reagan is saying up in heaven about what Donald Trump the kind of action that he took after this event occurred?
I think Ronald Reagan would have stepped up and would have said things properly. I do not see him as someone who would have been unwilling to denounce this racism, nativism, the violence, etc. So I do not see any former president. Honestly, George W. Bush spoke up after 9/11. He did not attack Muslims as a group. He was very proper in his reaction. I think every president has done that. And I even would say Dick Cheney, who was controversial as vice president, would have, you know, certainly would not approve of the kind of behavior of Trump, neither. So I think Trump is an unusual person and unique, and hopefully we will not have his kind again in the White House in the future. If we do, we're in trouble.
So regardless of political affiliation, and taking Reagan and Obama, two very different men in terms of their politics, they both would handle this very differently. And there's really
absolutely, and so would every other president, including Richard Nixon. Let's go back to Richard Nixon, who, again, because of Trump and because he had his own positive aspects to his presidency, Nixon definitely looks less evil and less bad as time goes by, although he certainly has plenty to answer for historically.
And there's really no political parties when it comes to discussing a tragedy like this. We put that aside.
That's correct. Political parties and partisanship should have nothing to do with the reaction on this kind of situation. And notice how many Republicans have spoken up against how Trump handled this on Saturday. So I'm saying there's a growing opposition to him within the Republican establishment, and that's why I think the movement to remove him over time is increasing, is accelerating.
How much of a a split in the Republican Party is this event going to cause, not to mention previous events, but it seems like Trump is distancing himself more and more, and will that hurt the next election? You talked about John Kasich, our governor here in Ohio, being a viable candidate for president in 2020. Is that going to affect him, or might people forget about it once the election comes around?
Well, it's hard to predict, because midterm elections, not everybody votes, not as many people vote. But I would think that the way things are going in this country, the outrage is growing, and that is going to really have an effect. And I think the Republican Party is realizing that Donald Trump doesn't care about the Republican Party. He's not really a Republican. He's not really a conservative. He's now attacking the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and he's also attacked Paul Ryan, and he's attacked everybody that you can imagine in the Republican Party. But going after the Senate Majority Leader, as he did last week before these events in Charlottesville, was stunning, because he needs McConnell to get anything done, and he's had no accomplishments legislatively at all. And I'm not a defender of McConnell personally. I'm still angry at what he did to Merrick Garland, the Supreme Court nominee of Barack Obama, would not give him a hearing. But forgetting that, the point is that to go after McConnell was a big mistake by Trump. And, of course, it creates an awkward situation, because McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, is Secretary of Transportation. So I'm wondering how Elaine Chao is reacting privately to her husband being attacked by her boss. And how long will she be in the cabinet as Secretary of Transportation? It's just the strangest situation we've ever seen. And, of course, all the people being fired, and you know, and now the talk of maybe Stephen Bannon being pushed out, which I think would be a good thing. But it's just so much chaos and anarchy. This is not the way the White House should be run.
As we know, Donald Trump has gone back and forth. He used to be a Democrat, and he's an independent. He's, I think he was a Democrat as recently as like 10 or 12 years ago. Although he does seem conservative, is he more of an independent? Again, he's not really a true Republican, but the fact that
he's an independent, capital R, yes. And he's someone who doesn't work well with others. He's got to be the number one person, always be right, never admit mistakes. He's a bully. He's a narcissist. And, you know, many people during the campaign overlooked that or decided to just, you know, ignore it. And unfortunately, it led to what's now happened. And the Republican Party heritage of Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt and Eisenhower and Reagan has been besmirched.
So he's an independent, but very different from myself. And again, I'm an independent, as I say.
Oh, my God, no comparison. He's not an independent, even like Ross Perot in 1992 and 1996, or John Anderson in 1980. And I wrote an article on History News Network saying that I thought John Anderson was the best non-major party candidate in my lifetime in 1980. I almost voted for him. I ended up not, but I almost did. And John Anderson is the perfect kind of an independent. And interestingly, John Anderson is still alive. He's now 95 years old and lives in Fort Lauderdale.
And Scott spoke with him earlier this year, so you can hear the interview.
I didn't hear that. What was that?
Scott Spears spoke with John Anderson earlier this year.
Oh, really?
You
oh,
can,
wow.
Hear the interview on our great website, of course, maintained and programmed by yours truly, WWGH1071.com. So Donald Trump's independence isn't like Perot's or Anderson's or mine. It's more driven by his arrogance. Would that be a good way to say it?
I didn't quite hear that. I'm sorry.
Donald Trump's independent, not really a true Republican or Democrat, is really more driven by his arrogance.
Absolutely. I mean, after we could say, although I was not a Ross Perot fan, that he was a businessman who had never been engaged in politics, but he was not the narcissist that Trump is. And, of course, John Anderson was a wonderful member of the House of Representatives from Illinois for 20-something years, a Republican leader before he decided to run as an independent for president. And, you know, even though he didn't do all that well, as far as, you know, percentage of the vote, only got 7%, I think he added to his dignity, and he still is someone that many people admire now in his mid-90s.
So a true independent is someone like Perot or Anderson or myself, where issues may run the gamut. We don't like to align with a particular party. We kind of independent thinkers, but sometimes you can at least take different types of issues, social issues, the economy, the environment, and at least say, is that person to the left or to the right? But it seems like as a for a president, you have to kind of be a member of a franchise, that is Republican or Democrat, in order to get support, to get funding, and hope to win an election. That you can be a mayor, especially of a smaller city, be a treasurer or some office like that, and be an independent. I mean, Bernie Sanders, for example, was an independent before he became a Democrat, you know, although he said he was a Democratic socialist, and made a run for president. He kind of understood that you had to be a member of the franchise in order to be a viable presidential candidate, but being a senator from a small state like Vermont, it was okay to be an independent. Would that be logical, or again, am I being a little too analytical there?
I think basically you can be elected possibly to the Senate. Angus King in Maine is an independent as well, Senator Angus King of Maine, and we've had a few others in history. But as far as for president, the only serious, I call it, third-party candidate was Teddy Roosevelt, former president, a Republican, running as a capital P progressive, Boom Moose Party in 1912, when he won six states and 88 electoral votes. And that's never been matched. And the closest to that was George Wallace, who is, of course, not quite the same kind of a person, pretty despicable. I have a chapter on my assassinations book on the attempted assassination of Wallace in 1972. But in 1968, he did run as a states' rights party candidate, actually as an independent, I'm sorry, not states' rights, that's Strom Thurmond, I'm sorry, in 1948, who's the third best performance in electoral votes. But George Wallace was second with 46 electoral votes in 1968, and Strom Thurmond in 1948, similar views on racial matters, won 39 electoral votes. But really, only T.R. was a national candidate winning states across the country in his total of six states. But third parties or independents do not win, do not win the White House.
Do you think there will be a lingering effect on the Republican Party, or maybe we'll have a third party due to repercussions from the Trump presidency? Is that a possibility?
I think
at all?
The Republican Party could be in its death throes as the name Republican Party. It might have to go, I think, the way of the Whig Party. I've joked and said the Whig Party, which had such luminaries as Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, and Abraham Lincoln before he became a Republican, that the Whig Party actually, you know, probably should come back. We should revive the name Whig Party, because I really think the Republican Party has been so damaged by Trump that it's going to be very hard to keep its reputation going.
Now, you talked about how in the past the Republican Party felt was superior, but now you feel the Democratic Party is superior. And certainly Trump is probably not helping his own party, again, being, though he's really an independent, being the Republican Party. How much will that change, and will the Republican Party ever regain its glory that it had many years ago?
I think it would be difficult. Again, it might, but I think the Republican Party really needs to repudiate Trump. And needs to move back toward the center. It's too far over, too far to the right, and that's not where politics wins. It's true he did win, and it was a fluke, I believe, how he won, but I do think that political parties need to be more in the center, with elements on the right in the Republican Party and on the left in the Democratic Party, but being too extreme is not a long-term prognosis for success.
Do you think that Mr. Obama moved the Democrats to the left, and was that part of the reason why Trump was elected? People wanted someone not quite so liberal. They saw, besides the email and the other so-called scandals, they saw Hillary as being another Obama, and they wanted a change?
Obama moved to the left, but not extreme left. You see, everybody sees things differently. I know people who think he was extreme left. I do not think so. I think he was to the left of center, which is certainly all right. To be the right of center is all right. I think John Kasich is to the right of center, but within the mainstream. And I think Obama to the left of center was in the mainstream as well. But there are many people on the far left, if you want to call them that, who are unhappy with Obama, that he didn't do a lot more. So I think he was to the left of center, but still within the mainstream, as I think John Kasich would be in the Republican Party, or John Huntsman, let's say.
Yeah, I saw Obama as being quite liberal, certainly the most liberal president in my lifetime.
Well, yes, as far as policy making, I'd say the most liberal since Lyndon Johnson in domestic, yes. Certainly more than Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton, that's true.
Yeah, Clinton, again, times were different, but Clinton seemed much more centrist, if not a bit to the right,
yes,
economically, which, again,
I think Carter was also. I think Carter disappointed a lot of liberals. Ted Kennedy ran against him, did not defeat him, but that's why My dissertation advisor, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis did not vote for Carter in 1980. They voted for John Anderson, and I, again, thought of voting for Anderson, was not happy with Carter at the time, but then decided I would vote for Carter to hopefully prevent Reagan. It didn't happen. But I was thinking, and it's interesting because I didn't know this, that if I had been aware that they were both going to vote, maybe I would have gone for Anderson.
And I was just a teenager and a preteen during Carter's presidency, but didn't it seem like the energy crisis, all the inflation, the high interest rates, that was kind of being blamed on the Democrats, and that's why a rather conservative person like Reagan got elected? I mean, you'd know better than
that. Well, yes, the oil embargo of the Arabs in 78, 79, which could have occurred under any president, I think caused the high inflation, caused the high interest rates. It made Carter a victim. But also, I always point out that the Iran hostage seizure that went on for 444 days, I think, is what ultimately defeated Carter. If he had been able to get the hostages out in April 1980, a failed mission, I think he would have won a second term. So I often have said when I've taught classes that I think what really defeated him was the two I's, Iran and inflation.
So we've talked about how Carter was, I mean, he's obviously a very good man, and I would certainly agree with you that he is the best ex-president ever. Someone who does,
as far as his activities after the White House, yes.
Someone who does, absolutely. Right, we talked about Bill Gates and his wife Melinda being philanthropic. I mean, Jimmy Carter certainly is, without all the fun, all the money, that the billions of dollars that Bill Gates has. And he's someone who really does care about his fellow Americans. And it's,
yes, and I
got to
say,
touching.
It's amazing. 2 years ago in July, he was diagnosed with cancer, and I thought, oh boy, he's near the end. And he's still with us. He's had a remission. He's going to be 93 in, what's it, another month and a half. It's just wonderful. I'm so happy about that.
I mean, he's somebody that you root for, regardless of whether or not you felt he was a good president. He was more a victim of circumstance. That's kind of what you're saying. Really,
I
wasn't,
think he was, yes, right. More a victim of circumstance. He was not the strongest, most assertive leader either, as far as his personality. But I think a lot of it was circumstance, but that's often what happens, unfortunately. So, but even his ranking has moved up, even without Trump, has moved up. He's certainly rated better now than he was. But it's a long time. He's been out of office for 36 and a half years. So there's plenty of time to reassess him even before he passes away.
Right. Trump and Carter, to me, they could not be more different, both being presidents.
Oh, absolutely. There's no comparison.
Right. Carter is,
between them.
He was always very humble.
Right. Because Trump, I don't see Trump doing any kind of good deeds after he leaves the presidency, anything like what Carter has done. Absolutely.
Right. And Carter, maybe a little too humble. I mean, we talk about Trump being arrogant, and you need to have confidence, self-confidence in yourself to be president, to be a business owner. And I speak of myself as a business owner. You have to be confident in what you do, but Donald Trump obviously takes that to the extreme, whereas Carter remains a very humble man.
Absolutely humble, which I think is one of the, even though it may have not helped him when he was president, I think it makes him look better historically as a personality.
So that humility may have been his downfall, but you gotta love him as a man. Plus, I think he had a very good...
I think there'll be a lot of mourning when he passes. Of course, it's somewhat anyway, but I think when he does pass away, it will focus on him and make him... I think his rate, unfortunately, is the way it often is, his ranking will go up once he passes away. It definitely helps.
Yeah, I would say he's certainly one of the most interesting former presidents to study, and that people, even if they weren't alive or they were very young during his presidency, just think of Jimmy Carter as almost being an American hero, being an icon, and a good role model for former presidents.
Yes, a good role model. And the thing is, when you go back to 1973, 74, 75, nobody would have thought that a man who was named James Earl Carter Jr. but said, no, I'm Jimmy Carter, that was so like shocking, because other Jameses, Madison, Monroe, Buchanan, didn't go around saying, I'm Jimmy Buchanan, Jimmy Monroe, Jimmy Madison. And I remember thinking, he's a nice-looking man with a nice smile who's governor of the southern state, a state, you know, that, you know, we have not elected a Southerner since 1848, Zachary Taylor, and the thought is, he's not going anywhere other than being governor, and it was stunning that he came out of basically what seems like nowhere, was known as Jimmy Who, and ended up in the White House. It's absolutely astounding.
Right. And as I told you, I was quite a fan of his brother, Billy, and Billy Beer. So I think, Billy was just a common guy, but the brother of the president, and his wife was a Southern belle. His mother, Lillian, had that charm to her. So his family, including Carter himself, just were folksy. But I think Carter also was probably one of our most intelligent presidents. You might not realize that right away, but in retrospect, and in seeing how he conducted himself, he obviously had a lot of dignity and was a gentleman. But he was,
not only that, but
he was quite a sharp guy,
according
too.
To what I've read, IQs, his is one of the highest IQs, and he has produced so many books and written so many books since, as Nixon, by the way, did also. Nixon wrote a lot of books after, published a lot of books after he was president. But Carter is one of the most intelligent, as far as pure IQ, of our presidents, no question about it.
And we, shortly after Carter, had Bill Clinton, someone else who went by his nickname and also was from the Deep South, and also was one of our most intelligent presidents. So I
absolutely, very intelligent, but unfortunately having major flaws, F-O-A-W-S, a real shame, because I think he could have done a lot better job if he had been able to control his behavior.
I guess one difference, too, between Carter and Clinton, we never really thought that Rosalynn would have political aspirations, that she was more of an old-fashioned wife. Again, a smart woman, and she had a great charm to her. But we kind of knew right away that Hillary had aspirations beyond First Lady, and of course we saw that.
Yes, well, she is unique in that regard. The only person earlier, and of course it couldn't have happened, that might have been thought of that way was Eleanor Roosevelt, but that was not going to be possible in her time.
Hillary being the first lady with a postgraduate degree, she was an attorney. Michelle Obama's an attorney, and never discussed Jill Biden at all, but as you know, Ron, she has the same degree you do, a PhD. She also continues to teach part-time like you do. So I always admire Jill Biden for continuing to be in the academic business, even while she was second lady, from my understanding. You don't hear a lot about
Jill Biden's a lovely person and very supportive of her husband. It's a great combination. And don't forget, Joe Biden lost his first wife and his daughter, and his two sons were injured just as he was elected to the Senate. And it took a few years till he met Jill, but she and he, of course, had a daughter. And it's been a wonderful team for the last 40 years. And she is a wonderful support person for her husband.
Yeah, you don't hear much about her, but she's interesting. And I do admire her for her education and for still continuing in her career while still supporting her husband with his political aspirations.
Absolutely. No, she definitely has been a great mother to the two sons. Of course, Beau Biden has passed away, plus her own daughter. And whenever she appeared in public as second lady, I always said, wow, this woman should be first lady. And as you know, I'm a Joe Biden fan. And even though he's getting up there in age, I have not dismissed the thought that at least in early polls, although this is so early, he is considered the front runner for the Democratic nomination. I don't think he'll get it. And there's a lot of issues to say he shouldn't, but because of his age, he'll be 78. But Joe Biden is the one person I think had he been the nominee, if his son had not died and he had entered the race, I believe he would have defeated Hillary Clinton and would have won the election, because he would have won the white working class vote of Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, and would have defeated Donald Trump.
Going back to our main topic about the tragedy in Charlottesville, we discussed just over the phone and through messaging, Ron, about the line that we draw between the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, the right to express yourself, and what is reasonable and where the First Amendment ends. And it certainly ends at hate speech. Any thoughts on that? Do we maybe need, we don't need to rewrite the Constitution, but do we need to clarify exactly what is freedom of speech and what is something you should not be saying?
Well, I feel like with Richard Spencer or Jared Taylor or Jason Kessler or David Duke, I can see them being on television or radio, even though maybe people wouldn't want to see or hear them. But I don't think that they should be allowed to have a meeting where they encourage violence and bloodshed, as happened in Charlottesville, or now being proposed at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And, of course, apparently canceled at Texas A&M and College Station. Because I think if it's going to be a public meeting, it's going to provoke violence and bloodshed, I don't think that should be allowed. But, of course, the courts have not always ruled that way. They've argued freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, that you cannot prevent such meetings. So I imagine there might be a court case about the Texas A&M cancellation. And I hear the University of Florida at Gainesville is going to go ahead with its September plan to have one of these white supremacists there, but it means possibly another situation like happened in Charlottesville.
Is there a solution to this? We want to allow freedom of speech, but not allow hate speech. And what is a hate group versus somebody who just has an opinion that you don't agree with. I think it's pretty obvious, but sometimes you talk about a college, they want to give equal time, just like radio stations do. And we're having Jared Taylor on with Scott in about 2 hours and 15 minutes. So does a line need to be drawn, or is the system broken?
I think the system is certainly to be contentious. I personally am not on the Supreme Court, but I would say allow them to be on the public airwaves, TV and radio, and of course they can write articles and publish articles, but I would not allow public assemblies where they get in large numbers with their Nazi, neo-Confederate, white supremacists and Klan outfits and provoke violence and provoke confrontation. I just think it's not fair to the public and it endangers the public. But as far as their right to speak and to be seen, outside of being in a public event, I would say certainly I would agree with that.
The Florida event is in your neck of the woods.
And well, it's about 300 miles from here, actually. Florida is a long state, but
right.
Yeah. But my son went to the University of Florida, my oldest son.
So should they cancel that event? And if they did, would there be protests? What is there a way to solve this at all?
Well, Texas A&M has just canceled the event, and the state legislature apparently is behind it. I would think they should, but apparently they're not planning to cancel the event. And we'll have, of course, many people saying that we're curbing freedom of assembly, but I just think when it comes to a group that promotes confrontation and violence, I do not think we have an obligation to have to allow them to have a public venue. But again, radio and TV and in print, no problem with that at all.
So you'd agree with me, Ron, that there is a way to draw the line, and it's probably a little more obvious than it seems. And again, being on the radio is not like having a public event. There are certainly differences.
Of course not. It's different. I definitely don't believe we can curb the ability of them to be seen or heard. No, but I don't think we should allow large numbers of people to come into a community and cause the kind of disruption and bloodshed that occurred at the University of Virginia. It really besmirches that great university.
Well, unfortunately, Ron, our show is going to end in about a minute and 35 seconds. It always seems like, even if the topic is not a pleasant one, like most of the topics discussed today, we do enjoy conversing on the air, and hopefully, my listeners, you've learned something, and we've given you some food for thought. Ron, you'll be back on with me or Scott, I'm sure, sometime in the near future. Any final words before we close out today's show?
Well, I want to thank you for inviting me again, and I just want to remind people about my book and paperback now, Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency, from Andrew Jackson to Barack Obama, Roman Littlefield Publishers, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or from Roman Littlefield Publishing Company. And of course, look at my blog, theprogressiveprofessor.com, and all my articles and all my interviews and all that are on that blog, theprogressiveprofessor.com, and I'm also on Facebook and Twitter.
And you're quite the tweeter, if I should say so myself. Your handle is at Politist.
Mostly sharing articles, not always making my own statements, but sharing articles, yes.
Right, at Politist for political and history.
Yeah, Politist is my Twitter name, yes.
For political.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
History expert. Thanks again, Ron. Have a great day there in beautiful Boca Raton in South Florida. We will connect again in the near future. Adam Lepp here with the concluding moments of Mid-Morning Coffee Break with Adam on every Tuesday between approximately 10:13 a.m. and 11 on The Talking Place. Linda's up next. Stay tuned. Adam Lepp.
You're listening to W.